Wanted to say a few words to open the lecture. Perimeter's happy to be hosting this special lecture of GWPI. GWPI and Perimeter are already interacting very strongly through all of the grad students, but I hope this is a sign that those interactions and that relationship will only continue to grow in the future. And I see a lot of familiar faces, but I also see a lot of unfamiliar faces. And so I'm happy to see you all here, and welcome to Perimeter. So now I'll hand it over to Jamie.
Thank you, Rob. So this is, I'd also like to thank everybody for coming. This is one of two lectures that we have every year, the Distinguished Lecture Series. We have one at Waterloo and one at Guelph. I'd like to thank two people, Linda Static, who's my assistant, and Leanne Kane at Perimeter, who both worked together to make this happen. This is the first time that we've had it away from the campus. So, and it's, like Rob said, it's a nice way to establish or kind of reaffirm these ties that we have with Perimeter, which is becoming a increasingly important or place for graduate students. So it's a real pleasure today to introduce Professor Martin Moskovitz, a fellow Canadian. He was educated at the University of Toronto, did all his undergraduate and graduate degrees there, and then stayed there as a faculty member. It was professor in 1982, and he was the chair of the department as well. During this time, he's also had very active research. He has over 200 papers. He's won a number of awards, and he's a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. And unfortunately, in 2000, as too often happens, he decided to leave Canada, and he went to University of California in Santa Barbara, where he was the Dean of Science from that time, 2000, until just a few months ago. So I'm sure he's very glad to, again, get back in the lab, and I hope you all join me in welcoming Professor Moskovitz. One other thing, there will be a wine and cheese reception, as usual, after the lecture, and that's going to be upstairs in the cheese room.
Thank you, Jamie. It's wonderful to be back to Canada. It's always like a pilgrimage for me to come back to Canada. I was mentioning to Bob Leroy earlier that I left Canada because they threatened to make me retire. Then, of course, they changed the rules as soon as I left. I guess they were waiting for me to go before they would change the rules. But then, ironically, I then spent the next 7 years trying to convince people to retire. Life does have its ironies. Santa Barbara is a magnificent place. We have a theoretical physics institute, which we're very proud of. It's called the Kavli Institute for Theoretical Physics. It's run by David Gross, who's no stranger to the Perimeter. I also like this very clever combination of Greek and Roman lettering. That was used as the symbol for the Perimeter Institute. And just to show you that I know what's responsible for this, I have my BlackBerry with me. It is turned off, though. One of the things that Santa Barbara is known for is its highly collaborative atmosphere, and it stands it in good stead. But when I was dean, it was particularly good for me because it meant that the members of my group had an extended family to look after their interests while I was doing other things, less important things, but nevertheless things that were my duty to do. And what I'm going to talk to you about is the product of a very vast collaboration. I'm just going to mention two of my colleagues, Norbert Reich, who's a biochemist, and Carl Meinhardt, who's in the mechanical engineering department, who is an expert in microchannel and other MEMS technologies. And the group of people who actually did the work, Gary Brown, Sung Jun Lee, Brian Fiorek, Martin Shearhorn, and Dwight, and they are graduate students and postdocs who work for the three of us. and sometimes they work for us solely, but take advantage of the wisdom and knowledge that the others have. I'm sure they can't say the same for me, but sometimes we actually share them outright. So I'm going to talk a little bit about a very old story, but that has a kind of new new aspect. It has to do with surface-enhanced Raman. And it's interesting, and I chose my words carefully here. It was first observed in 1974 by Fleischmann and Hendra, but it was not discovered until 1977. I make that distinction because although Fleischmann and Hendra observed the effect, they didn't understand what it was. And in a nutshell, Raman spectroscopy is an inelastic form of spectroscopy in which a material is excited by a laser. And then you have sidebands that are created that are normally due to a mixture of excitations of the incoming photon with either vibrations or rotations or other excitations of the material. And that excitation can create photons that are either less energetic or more energetic than the incident photon. And the difference in energies usually corresponds to some lost channel, like a vibration or a rotation. And this is a rather trivial form of spectroscopy that's practiced in chemistry labs and physics labs all the time. And what the observation showed that occurred in 74, but was not recognized until 77 by Rick Van Dyne, was that the Raman signal of molecules that exist near micro rough or nano rough, in today's parlance, surfaces, could be enhanced by many orders of magnitude. It wasn't a factor of 2 or 4 or 10 or 20 or 100. It was a million. And so clearly, you know, when confronted with a million, you take notice. And and then I had the good fortune at that time to be interested in rough surfaces. I had a student, a fellow by the name of Peter McBreen, who is now at Laval University, who was making purposely rough surfaces by condensing metal under ultra-high vacuum conditions at very low temperatures. And the metal atoms would fall on the surface, and their energy would dissipate quickly, and so their diffusion on the surface was curtailed, and so they would end up sticking to places that were not necessarily the energetically most favorable places. And as a result, you would have a rough surface. And we looked at the optical properties of these surfaces, and they had various anomalies. And in the literature, people used very ad hoc ways to deal with the optical properties of rough surfaces that were not really based in physics. And so we had to develop these things. And so I use as a simple model a plane surface with small particles on it, and then found that Gustav Mie had solved that problem in 1908. And so the problem was there, and lots of literature was there. And in fact, that sort of zero-order model gave many of the robust physical features of how these rough surfaces behave. And I'll tell you what the anomalies are due to. They're called localized surface plasmons. But then when I saw this effect, I then wrote a paper literally in one day saying, oh, this is undoubtedly due to the excitation of localized surface plasmons. And that was my entry into this effect. Now, this was a long time ago, you know. I mean, some of us were not even born in the 70s. I see at least two people who were barely born in the 70s. Or if they were born, it was an accident. And so there it lay for a number of years, this effect. And then it was rediscovered in 1996 as a single molecule phenomenon. In other words, the fact that if you use the right kind of structures, you can actually see a surface-enhanced Raman from a single molecule. Now, Raman is an emissive effect. And so, in principle, by having a low enough background and counting long enough, you could always see a single molecule. And so why did this attract attention? So an enhancement that would be newsworthy 20 years after the discovery is the fact that the cross section of Raman was suddenly put into a category that one normally associates with fluorescence. Right? Single molecule fluorescence is a field that's been studied for a very long time. There are all sorts of interesting dynamical problems there. Suddenly, you see this this same thing happening in Raman. And so in order for this to be truly competitive, then you have to have a level of enhancement that would bring the effective cross-section of Raman into the neighborhood of fluorescence cross-section. So that would require 10 or 11 orders of magnitude of enhancement. And now that becomes truly puzzling. And so people said, what Moskowitz told us about plasmons in 78 can't be true, because everybody predicts 6 orders of magnitude, and we need 10. And so then at that point, I wrote another paper, and I called it SIRS and the Single Molecule. And only very old people in the audience will understand why that is a funny title. And I said, no, you don't understand. The single molecule SIRS was also predicted in the 1980s, except that we were not technologically capable of taking advantage of it, so it was forgotten. And so now you have a series of observations and discoveries and rediscoveries. And that's why I put that picture up there of Columbus discovering America. Because if you look very carefully, there are people behind the tree there who had discovered America thousands of years before Columbus. And so, like SIRS, that was a rediscovery. And so the physics behind SIRS is really trivially simple. If you have a small particle that's small compared to the wavelength of light, and it is metallic, so there are conduction electrons, you can write down its polarizability in closed form. If you say that the particle is small compared to the wavelength of light, but not so small that bulk optical properties can't be assumed for it, then you can plug in an expression for the dielectric function of the metal into alpha, and you have the expression in the second line. And you see that expression has a pole when omega r equals omega p over square root of Eb plus 3. Now, Eb is my shorthand form for the component of the dielectric function that comes from interband transitions. And this this little equation tells you all of the important conditions that must be met for you to see SIRS. Okay? First of all, you have to be resonant. You have to have light that is resonant with these dynamical processes. And what is this dynamical process? This is a process in which the conduction electrons collectively oscillate against the ion cores of the metal. That's why it's called a plasmon resonance. It's sort of like a charged plasma that's oscillating. You also see that the condition is highly dependent on how much contribution there is from interband transitions. And that's the secret behind, for example, why silver and gold are excited in the visible rather than in the ultraviolet, because omega p lies in the ultraviolet. It's about 9 eV for silver and gold. And if it weren't for epsilon b, there. That resonance would be 9 divided by root 3, which would still be pretty far into the UV. But because of these interband transitions, and you know that gold has them because it's gold. Otherwise, it wouldn't have that color. This pushes these resonances into the visible. And so poor chemists and physicists who have cheap lasers that don't go into the UV can then excite these transitions. But in addition to that, the quality of the resonance is given by that expression, right? So when you are in resonance, the real part of the denominator vanishes. And so the quality of the resonance, how sharp that resonance will depend on gamma. And gamma is, in fact, the electron collision rate. And so when the electron collision rate is low, you've got a metal that is very conductive. And when it's high, you have a metal that is not so conductive. And so that also explains, tells you, predicts which metals are likely to show this effect in a very sharp way. And so you need a good conductor. And so good conductors are copper, silver, and gold. And the alkali metals, which people have shown this effect in very strongly, but of course they're harder to work with. And all the other metals are poorer by virtue of their conductance. And you also, let me do this first. You also can see that this effect is only good in the nano domain. So this is actually one of the few real nano effects. Why? Because if the particle is too small, then collisions with the boundaries of the particle become competitive with the inherent collisions or scattering processes of the electrons in the metal, and so the conductance becomes lower and lower, the quality factor becomes poorer and poorer, and the effect disappears. On the other hand, if you make the particle too large, then of course the electric field is no longer quasi-static across the boundary of the particle, and you start exciting quadrupoles and octupoles and all of these other things, which are non-radiative excitations that are then denatured to heat, and so you're wasting a lot of the photons. And so the effect becomes optimal in the sort of nano range, and it goes away as you make the particles too small or too large. And in fact, it's not an accident that Raman was the effect that was seen first, because Raman actually benefits from these various plasmonic excitations in a very unusual way. And this is shown sort of schematically there. If I had a laser, I would point to that hand-drawn metal sphere with a single molecule on top of it. And the single molecule, thank you very much. The single molecule then is illuminated both by the incident field, but also by the re-radiated field of the oscillating dipole that is set up. And you can see that when you do calculations, that what happens is that an incident field excites this dipole that then re-radiates and coherently superimposes with the incident field, and then redistributes energy from space into the vicinity of the particle. In fact, you can see it here much better. See, it robs a lot of energy here and then places it over here. And if your molecule is over here, then your molecule sees a much more intense field than it would see in space. And so it would then radiate, very simplistically, beta times the incident. It would see a field beta times the incident field. And then it would then scatter a scattered field, ES, that is alpha times beta times the scattered field. But you know, this scattering is in every direction, and so some of it is scattered back to the metal particle, and the metal particle doesn't care where it gets its field from, and so this metal particle re-enhances the scattered light, and so now the secondarily scattered light benefits from this field enhancement more or less as a square of that. For silver, beta is of the order of 20 to 30. So if it's 30, then 30 times 30 is, say, 1,000 in round numbers. The intensity is the square modulus of that, and so you get this you get a million-fold enhancement, and that explains a million-fold enhancement from a single particle. But it doesn't explain these 10 to the 10 and 10 to the 11, and that will be explained later. And in a nutshell, what you found is that in most cases you don't really see SIRs from single particles. Most SIRs experiments really were done, and most calculations these days are done on systems, on aggregates. So you can have a dimer. These are two nanoparticles with stuff in the middle. These are nanoparticles at the end of glass rods. You can have particles tethered to a surface. Here's an interesting experiment. You have a silver nanowire in which a very small current was passed, and so eventually a tiny gap was created. And when you put molecules there, you find that almost all of the enhancement, the molecules are everywhere, but almost all of the enhancement comes from the gap. Very little comes elsewhere. You see a little bit here because there's some structure there, and so on. And what became obvious is that really these plasmon resonances can interact. So if you have two particles that act like quasi point dipoles, when you bring them close together, of course you can't describe them as point dipoles because they're too close together, but you can do this calculation in closed form, basically solving Maxwell's equations in one of a variety of ways. For example, you can do the coupled dipole approximation, in which you replace all this volume with a bunch of interacting dipoles, and you use more and more dipoles in order to get better and better convergences and to mimic the structures better and better. And then what you see is that the field that was originally located at these poles, by virtue of the fact that you depleted the energy from parts of space, could be then further concentrated in an interstice. But it depends, of course, on the polarization. So when your polarization is this way, then you create what has now been called a hot spot. And when your polarization is this way, then, of course, you don't get very much out of this. This was actually predicted by Horia and Metru in 1980. And so if you do this calculation, you find that, and of course now you have to add up many, many multipoles. This was not a discrete dipole approximation calculation. This was actually just a multipolar expansion. When you have 40 multipoles in the sum, you get pretty good convergence. And then what you see is that you go from just 5.5 orders of magnitude, which is what a single particle gives you, and you can add another 5 or 6 orders of magnitude of enhancement. But of course, the molecule has to be there to enjoy that enhancement. If it's somewhere else, it doesn't do it. However, if you can figure out a way to ensure that the molecule is in that interstice, then indeed you will see an emission that is competitive with fluorescence. And you know, since then, lots of people have done all sorts of engineering feats using e-beam lithography. This is from the work of Shalhoub and his group, making these beautiful nano antennas, as they call them, which are basically interacting silver particles. You can put a layer of silver separated by a thin layer of dielectric underneath it and further enhance these things. You can do all sorts of interesting engineering feats to maximize these things. And you can see, for example, if your light is polarized this way, now you can look at 4 log E or modulus of E across this way, you see that the interstice is very hot, hotter by about four orders of magnitude above the edges. Or you can go across this way, and then only in the middle here do you get anything worth talking about. And there you can see a single molecules. Now, this interest in SIRS actually has now expanded to encompass other phenomena in which plasmons are involved, and it's created a whole new field called plasmonics. There are plasmonic crystals that have band gaps, more or less like photonic crystals do, and they have certain benefits and certain drawbacks from as compared to photonic crystals. And there are all sorts of interesting phenomena. A lot of it is sort of phenomenology rather than really strikingly new physics, but nevertheless very interesting stuff. You can show that you can engineer particles to have to localize your excitations wherever you want with whatever spectroscopic capabilities you want. What's interesting is that the ancients knew about these particles. So, for example, most of the brilliant red colors in this stained glass is due to gold, and most of the other particles are due to other metal particles. And the reason that people needed to use these is that organic dyes bleach, and if you have a window, then the light's going to hit it. That's the idea of a window. And so, and if you want your cathedral to have a stained glass for 400 or 600 or 800 years, then you can't have bleach. And so they knew that the metal was somehow being dissolved in a subdivided state. And this sample is from the Royal Institution. This was a gold collar prepared by Michael Faraday and is stable still. And Michael Faraday also calculated, with his tremendous intuition, he calculated the ballpark of the size of the particles involved correctly. Great, great intuitive mind. This is actually the spectrum of this beautiful cup that's in the British Museum. It's called a Ligurian cup, and it's a early medieval glass that has gold particles, and you can see that the observed spectrum and the Mie theory agree really quite well. So it's clear that that you have that. Also, I'm going to skip this a little bit. Also, there's an interest in what's known as metamaterials these days, and there's a link between plasmons and metamaterials, because most of the materials that show hope of optical metamaterial, optical left-hand optical properties occur when you have properly shaped systems in near their plasmon resonance. And this is an interesting simulation. If you have these silver nanowires, somehow, this is of course calculation, we're actually trying to make these things, but that's not what I'm going to talk about today. If you have these silver nanowires that flare out in this particular way, then you can show that their optical properties will have these metamaterial properties in which the group velocity and the phase velocity actually counterpropagate, which gives you the impression, although the people in the metamaterials say that it does have a negative refractive index. So with a negative refractive index, of course, Snell's law that normally causes things to diverge one way causes them to diverge the other way. And so the material actually, the phases of the light actually counterpropagate against the direction in which you they began. And if you, for example, take a small sphere, and a metal sphere, and put it inside here, then you see an interesting cloaking phenomenon in which the sphere sort of disappears in the far field. So in the absence of this material, you have a set of plane waves that impinges on this material, and you see the diffractive optics that result. But nevertheless, in the direction of the group velocity, ultimately there will be a kind of shadowing effect, even though, of course, it's complex because of the diffraction effect. Nevertheless, there's a kind of shadowing effect. So you can, in the far field where you are here, you see the object. But if you put this, if you embed it in the metamaterial, what happens is that these wave fronts sort of collapse again, so that in the far field, it seems to have caused the object to disappear. So it seems to be transparent. And these really are outgrowths of the whole CSIRS situation. And of course, once the insight about these hotspots came about, people started coming up with all sorts of calculations of configurations that would show these hotspots. This is a series of, this is a hexagonal pattern, and the hotspots are like this when you polarize this way, and they're over here when you polarize that way. And so we decided to actually make these things, and we made them using a material called anodic oxide, which can form these pores, and we know how to make them very uniforms, very periodic and uniform. And then we can also dissolve them out. So if you have large pores and then deposit silver in them, then you have the silver rods close together. And if you have small pores and you deposit silver and the silver particles are far apart, and in fact, you can see that a couple of things. First of all, here's what they really look like. These are silver nano rods, in which we've etched away just the 50 nanometers at the top. So you have sort of these little pills of silver. These, I overlaid the calculated hot spots depending on the polarization. And here we compare the actual calculated enhancement and the experimental enhancement of two different wavelengths, and you can see fairly good agreement. It's not perfect, but it's fairly good agreement. But also, you can see that purely geometrically changing the parameters here can give you an almost three orders of magnitude increase in enhancement. So you can, for this sample, for example, you can begin to see single molecule Raman if you use a very dilute solution of some molecule that you want to see. Then you'll almost certainly see it. Years ago, two Russians, Stockman and Chalaev, showed that there's a whole other class of materials that can show these large localizations. And these are fractal clusters of nanoparticles. And they showed something very interesting. It was a nice piece of math because they showed that they did a closed form calculation. They showed that if this thing was a fractal that had self that had scaling symmetry over enough orders of magnitude, that the clash between the symmetry of the light that excites it, which ultimately is a periodic structure because of the wavelength, and the aperiodic nature of the fractal, which has dilational symmetry, causes a symmetry breaking to occur, which in general makes it impossible to localize the normal modes of these clusters. And so they will have to be it makes it impossible to delocalize, rather, which makes them all localized. And so, in general, the normal modes will create hot spots. And this you can look at it either as a piece of math, or you can just do the simulation. And the simulation is basically a bit of coherent superposition of excitations with the right phases and whatnot, and you find that, of course, you basically cancel out the effects of most of the cluster, and you only allow the excitations to be very bold in very small regions, localized regions of the cluster. And we actually we actually map these things out using so-called near-field scanning optical microscopy, and you can actually see these hot spots at various wavelengths on these fractal clusters. So now I think, you know, took 30 years, but I think now we truly understand the physics sufficiently to be able to do chemistry and engineering on these things and ask ourselves, you know, how do we co-locate molecules that we want to see with the hot spots? And so one way is to cause the molecule to create the hot spot itself. So with something like a colloidal particle. A colloidal particle is stabilized because there are ions that are absorbed on the surface. And so the shorthand of the forces that that both attract and repel these particles are as follows. You have an attractive van der Waals force, which is fairly short range. You have a very short range repulsive force due to the fact that when you bring them too close together, a whole bunch of things interact. But in addition to that, of course, you have the Coulomb repulsion due to these particles. And so what happens is, and this is what stabilizes these particles in solution, when they come from over here where the energy eventually goes to zero, they see a barrier, a Coulomb barrier, which if they had enough KT to overcome, they would eventually find themselves in here and come together. And so one way to reduce the barrier is to replace charged particles with uncharged particles. And that's the secret to all these this clustering. However, if you can create a molecule that has two ends, both ends love silver, let's say, then you might be able to overcome this Coulomb repulsion simply by virtue of the infrequent motion of these particles together that then causes these ends to bind, to glue, as it were, to these things. And then, so long as the chemical attraction overwhelms the Coulombic attraction, they will stick together. And so in order to bring particles together just by replacing their charges, you have to replace enough charges. But if you use these doubly sticky ligands, you don't have to replace many charges. You might not even have to replace more than one or two. And in fact, that works perfectly well. Here's an example. So here are particles that are covered with single-stranded DNA oligomers. There's an A type and a B type. And here you have an A type, and here you have a B type. And so you see that, yes, by replacing some of the charges, you did create some small numbers of clusters because, you know, they come together. However, if you use this this bridging species, which is really a double-stranded DNA with overhangs, this overhang recognizes is complementary to A, and this overhang is complementary to B, then this will bridge it. And then it creates much, much larger clusters because, in fact, now it doesn't have the Coulombic repulsion that remains here is insufficient to prevent this binding from taking place. And in fact, we could do this with such a low concentration of this species C that the on average, the link that brings these things together is a single molecule. So only one. There's only one of these Cs in any one of these areas. By the way, this has an interesting application. We didn't do it to illustrate this effect. We did it for a much more important reason. So, for example, there are a number of proteins that are sequence-specific DNA binding proteins. Clearly, you know, anything that DNA comes together and falls apart within a protein matrix of some sort. And so these protein matrices have to be created through evolution in such a way that they recognize specific. So, you know, there are a couple of them you can buy. And so if you do that, then you can, if you use the right sequence in here, then the protein will actually interact with it. And then you'll see a spectrum due to a tag that we put on the protein. And if you have the wrong sequence here and put the protein there, you see nothing. So in fact, this then becomes a very sensitive detector of this particular protein. And this spectrum, we estimate it comes from no more than 2 protein molecules. So this is, it could be more than 1 molecule, but no more than 2. So 1 or 2 molecules is what's responsible for this spectrum. Now, I'll skip this because time is getting short. I want to get to other things. So now we can do all sorts of clever things with it. Now that we know that getting designing molecules, and you know, you talk to chemists and you tell them, can you design molecules? And they generally say, no, I don't want to design your molecules. I want to design my molecules. And so you have to create the kind of collaborative atmosphere where people are excited about this. And so you tell them, you bring them into a big project rather than, hey, can you design a molecule for me? You are a partner. And so that's what we did. And a fellow's name is Guy Bazin, and he designed a bunch of molecules, another Canadian, by the way, that have these 2 ends that love silver. And then we can then bring these things together. And then we can do some post-engineering on it. So for example, you get this distribution. But then if you use centrifugation, you can throw away most of the higher ones. You can even throw away the monomers and have something that is overwhelmingly dimer. And then you can coat them with a polymer. And you can choose, you know, polymer chemists are very clever. So you can choose a polymer that's very, very impervious. And so once you've made this link, nothing else can get into the hotspot. That's it. And so you will always see only the spectrum of the molecules that are in the hotspot. And that's all. Or you can say, oh, wait a second. Maybe I can put some sensor there that senses, let's say, hydrogen ions, and then have a polymer coat that specifically passes hydrogen ions, but nothing else. Or, you know, maybe lithium. But anything bigger can go through the holes. And then you can add, this is organic, and so, you know, a good organic chemist can figure out how to attach things to it. You can attach antibodies or other molecular recognition entities. And then you have tags that when they encounter whatever it is that this is supposed to recognize, the biomarker that's supposed to recognize, it will bind to it. And when you shine your laser on it, you'll see this reporting. You'll say, this species is a tag that says, oh, you know, I've just found, or my host has just found something on that cell or on that membrane or on that vesicle, etc., that has been recognized by this thing, and wash it away. And if it washes away, then it's not it. But if it doesn't wash away, means that I am bound to that particular species. And so this becomes the reporter of that molecular recognition event. And you know, we can show that we can make this in with various reporters. ABT and OPV are just meaningless names for 2 reporters. This is basically a time sequence through a microchannel in which we're seeing individual tags that have been attached to to little spheres passing through, and you can see that, you know, they come, they go, etc. If you stop the flow, you see nothing because, you know, on average, there's nothing in the beam. You only see individual entities that come through, and you can recognize the one from the other very well. And so we've bought some cells that express certain biological markers on their coat, and we have we use two different reporter molecules, and on their coat we have the equivalent, the correct antibody that recognizes those things. And so by washing them through the cells, we can immediately see which cell expresses the one biomarker and which cell expresses the other biomarker. And it's in most cases, you only have one or two of these biomarkers, and yet you get very, very strong signals. And here's a kind of a closer up look at these things, a few of these cells. The blue and the red are different markers. And they are foolproof. If they don't have, if that marker is not there, you don't see anything. And they're competitive with fluorescence. They're as bright as fluorescence. And so now we said, well, let's see, in fact, if we can we can see pH at a local level. In other words, if we can measure hydrogen ion concentration in volumes that are a few cubic nanometers. And so we made this thing. But now, before encapsulating it in polymer, we've put in a molecule that just sort of hangs in there. It's called MBA. It's a benzoic acid. And you know, the benzoic acid has one form when it's in an acidic and another form when it's in a basic medium. And so then we encapsulate it. And so now this thing is in there for good. And we put the antibody in there. And sure enough, it works. It works very well. We can calibrate it very well. We put it in different buffers that have different pHs, and you see that some bands don't change, and some bands change a lot depending on the pH. And so you have an internal standard. You can take the ratio of a band that changes to a band that doesn't change, and that becomes then a measure of the local pH. And here you see that it's basically something that measures pH nicely in from, say, about 5 up, much less so elsewhere. But that's OK, because if you want to use this in biology, this is really the range that's probably interesting. And this is just a few days old, this result. But it works. Here we have a HeLa cell. It's a human cancer cell. There are known biomarkers on the surface. We have used the right antibody in order to attach this species to the cell, and you see that in fact in the vicinity of the cell coat, you have loads and loads of sites where the pH apparently is very low. We don't understand that. I'm not even a biologist, so I wouldn't understand it even when it was explained to me. But even the biologists don't understand that yet. But we will. I mean, we'll do more of this investigation. But you see, it's very, very marked. And this is all in a 7.1 pH buffer. And so there really shouldn't be any acidic areas here, unless there is, as part of the, this is a living cell, of course, as part of the functioning of the cell, there is a redistribution of hydrogen ions to bring this about. So here's another interesting experiment that was done with Brian Purick and Carl Meinhardt. Basically, we created a microchannel that's open at the top, and so gas can permeate into it. There's a little liquid reservoir here. There's a deep portion and then a shallow portion. And then there's a little heater here. And so the stuff that comes over here gets heated and goes away. And so this then becomes a unidirectional flow system. The flow is entirely by capillary forces, driven by the fact that this is always empty or almost always empty, and this is full. And so a single drop silver hydrosol lasts something like 12 hours before it's exhausted. So it's a very, very, very little material passes through. And what you see, this is, these are the measured intensities as a function of position. And what you see is a kind of increase to a maximum and then a kind of gentle decrease. And this line is due to a massive calculation that takes into account the diffusion of gas across the interface, the diffusion of gas through the liquid, the binding of the gas to the nanoparticles, the coming together by diffusion of the particles, forming dimers, then trimers, et cetera, et cetera. So the, and you get this line. Now, why is it you have all this noise around it? Well, that's small particle statistics, because on average, there are 6 dimers that cross through the laser beam. And so what we're doing here is the following. We have a channel. It's open. There's gas from the air that interacts with the surface of the channel. The gas enters the water. It diffuses. It finds a particle. All of this is over a flowing system. And because it's a flowing system, time, and it's always being, matter is being created at this point over here. And so time is proportional to distance. And so by probing down the channel, you're really probing the evolution of this process as a function of time. Over here, you have very few molecules that have actually interacted. Here, more molecules have interacted with the particles, and the particles start to come together. Here, you have dimers forming. Here, you have trimers forming. Here, you have tetramers forming, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, you have distributions, the right kind of distribution as you walk along. But what you don't know is just how enhancing the dimer is, the trimer is, et cetera, et cetera. But you can then estimate that. You can say, well, if I believe my simulation, then I'm going to choose a set of cross sections that will more or less put this line through this. And what you find is that the dimer is about 5 times more enhancing than the trimer. That's about twice as enhancing as a tetramer, and it's almost equally enhancing. This is on a per molecule basis. And just to show that this is true, we plot this as a against the dimer, the simulated dimer concentration, and you see that it goes through this very noisy line. Now, we can do other statistics on this. Remember, the dimer only enhances when the plane of polarization coincides with an internuclear axis. If this molecule can rotationally average in all directions, then in fact, very few of the molecules will align themselves, will have a component that's aligned appropriately with the plane of polarization. But in fact, you see many more events than that calculation predicts. And that implies that because the channel is small, the molecules prefer a non-rotationally averaged mode of flow. That they actually, there's a propensity for them to flow with a long axis, but not a full propensity. In other words, there's some give, and we can actually estimate that. And we can then plot this distribution curve, which I haven't showed here, but we can do that. And so this is very, very rich in information. And not only is it rich in fundamental information on the dynamics of what is happening and how how enhancing per molecule various clusters are. But it's also a good sensor. So this is a detection of cocaine vapor. This is California, so you know. And so what we did is we asked an undergraduate to come into the lab. He didn't know why, right? And but we, of course, we did buy some cocaine. You can buy cocaine legally if you do research, so long as they're small particles. Quantities, and we determined the SIR spectrum of cocaine by actually putting cocaine into the channel. That's the spectrum. And then we brought in the undergraduate and we said, stand around here. And this is what we saw. Clearly there was cocaine in the room. Right? And we actually did a statistical sampling of 2,400 undergraduates. A variety of genders, social strata and backgrounds, et cetera. And that's going to be published in a social science journal. Actually, we didn't do that. I'm just lying to you. We took our bot sample of cocaine and we put it 3 meters away on a small Petri dish. And we waited about 3 minutes, and that's the spectrum that we saw, and we estimated that was roughly 30 or 40 parts per billion of cocaine in the room. Well, I think I'm going to end there because time is up, and I'll thank you for your hospitality, and summarize by saying SIRS is primarily a plasmonic phenomenon. Its discovery gave birth to the fields of plasmonics and to resurgence of interest in metamaterials, which actually is a fairly old study. And, you know, I think we understand the phenomenon well enough that now we can use it to engineer important things. And since this is a theoretical institute, although, you know, this is the kind of theory that gets people excited these days, I should say that almost everything that we've done, all the simulations, et cetera, that not all, just we, but everybody else, are really just solutions of the Maxwell's equations. Quantum mechanics really is almost non-existent in this thing. And in fact, a good quantum mechanical treatment of plasmonic effects is still not really available. There are a few papers that are quite interesting. Including a good treatment of the conversion of a plasmon, which is a multi-electron dynamical effect, into single electron excitations. In other words, you have some plasmonic thing, like a particle that's undergoing plasmonic excitation. It's near a molecule. And then you see the molecule fluoresce. Clearly, there was an energy transfer from the plasma. How does that happen? I mean, there are umpteen papers on all sorts of energy transfer, Forster transfer, et cetera. Many, many well-known understanding of how one molecule can transfer energy to the other. But how do you transfer the energy of a dynamical system of thousands of electrons to a single electron excitation on a molecule? I think it's worth doing, and I think it can truly start a whole different direction for in plasmonics that has not been used, considered heretofore. And with that, I thank you very much, and I'll answer whatever questions. Thank you. Oh, we elicited that from a statistical analysis of what we did. We used a more and more dilute system, and then estimated the probability of finding more than two. We knew that we had a single link. And so then we estimated at what level of concentration we would have no more than two particles at the same time within our laser focus, our laser volume. But it was an estimate. So that was an average. I should say that that was not a spectrum of the protein. That was the spectrum of a marker molecule. It was a functionalized protein, and it was a spectrum of a marker molecule that we chose appropriately because it had a very large Raman cross-section. But you can buy these things labeled in that way. Actually, probably with what I've shown you, that might be true. But we've done that experiment many, many times. And so now we have many, many more points. And the only way you could put an oscillation in there is if you choose the curve to go through points that are not all from the same run. See what I mean? In other words, the totality of points, of course, are thick because of the noise, and so you could put anything you want between them, but there is no indication that within a given run there is a propensity for that other maximum. But I think that it's something I have to think about more deeply. I guess you are right that certainly as if you have smaller undulations, then we would not be able to say for sure that they're not there. Yes, and this is more or less what this is. This is SIRS, but in fact, the SIRS spectrum looks very much like cocaine in water or alcohol or whatnot. There are differences, but then, of course, you know, this is much, much lower concentration than this, maybe five orders of magnitude. And so there are other things there, and that's probably all sorts of junk from the other junk in the air. But the important features that basically tell the story are all there. Yes, it is possible, and people have done that. We've done that. Other people have done that. So that's that. The I didn't want to complicate the lecture by talking about that. But the question was, you know, some molecules have inherent resonances that create cross-sectional enhancements without the metal there by 2-3 orders of magnitude. What happens when you combine the two? And the answer is actually a bit more complex because when you're near a metal, there are also quenching processes that take place. And so you have this interplay. But the bottom line is that in many cases, you do get 2-3 orders of magnitude on top of what you see there. In addition to that, you also can open up new resonances that are charge transfer resonances due to the fact that you can have excitations from the metal to the molecule or from the molecule to the metal. And so you can have molecules that are transparent normally, and then suddenly you put it in there and you have these anomalous cross sections, and you can see these things. So there's a very rich area there. Yes, the answer is yes. I could probably find a study that we did in which we could, by increasing the intensity, we can actually start breaking up these clusters. We modeled it by a thermal process, and we found that you could have local temperatures that cause the break of the order of 800 or 900 Kelvin with tens of milliwatts. So most of these things are done with microwatts of power. And if you use too high a power, then you fry the system. These are huge enhancements. They are very localized. They can you can create multi-photon processes very easily, large nonlinear processes. And yes, they'll just go if you use too much power. But you know, you learn how to avoid that. Well, it depends what you mean by quantitative. Making it truly quantitative is difficult, and even all of the stuff that I've shown you is not truly quantitative. In other words, the trends are pretty good, factors of two, factors of three, but if you have details, I don't think that we can do that. For one thing, the plasmon is very sensitive to actual geometry, not this is a sphere. Well, it's not a sphere. This is a circle. It's not circular. It's got facets, etc. So I think real quantitative stuff is still hard to do, but you get good excellent trends. I actually started out with bumpy surfaces. And if the bumps are small compared to the wavelength of light in all dimensions, then you can treat that as an optically homogeneous layer with effective optical constants. But then the question is, what are the effective optical constants? And there are good approaches to doing that. These days, of course, you don't need to do that. You can actually you can solve Maxwell's equations for these randomly rough surfaces and actually show what and get the superposition of what the Fresnel equations would give you, which would be good reflections and transmissions, etc., through them, but through a layer, some transition layer that has effective optical constants. So you don't even have to know the optical constant; you just know exactly what the reflection and the transmission do as a function of wavelength, function of angle, etc. But the early stuff did use those techniques, and they gave pretty good agreements. I actually was tempted to show one of the things, but got so long and whatnot. Yes, and I spoke to Martin Fleischmann. Martin Fleischmann was an outstanding electrochemist who unfortunately ruined his reputation because of cold fusion. And I felt very bad because he was actually a gentleman and a great scholar and a great electrochemist. And I believe that the two things are connected. If you remember when cold fusion came out, there was actually another group by the name of Jones at Brigham Young that published a perfectly believable report of a fractional increase in cross-section due to the effect of palladium. Now, I visited Martin Fleischmann in the early 80s when he was in Southampton, and he believed that CSIRS would get the Nobel Prize at that time and that he missed out because of this blunder. The blunder was as follows. He saw this effect, and he attributed it to the increased surface area. He said, oh, it's more intense because we roughened the surface and the surface area is larger, and so we're actually looking at more molecules. If he had done a back of an envelope calculation, he would have seen that that would not be possible. You can get the factor of 2 or 5 or maybe 10, etc., but you don't get 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 5. So that was the blunder. And so I believe, and of course this is totally anhistoric, but I believe that when he heard that Jones saw this effect and they had this molten, etc., that they decided to go to the press so that he wouldn't miss the Nobel Prize one more time. So SIRS, it may actually be responsible for cold fusion. Somebody was good enough to give me his laser.